Greetings and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I am Chisa Kores, the chair of the club's Science and Technology Member-led Forum and your co-chair for today. We also welcome our listening audience and we invite everyone to visit us online at commonwealthclub.org. And now it is my pleasure to introduce our distinguished speaker, Mark Shapiro. Mark Shapiro has been exploring the intersection between the environment, economics, and international political power in books, magazine articles, and on television for three decades. Mark was formerly senior correspondent at the Center for Investigative Reporting. His work is published in Harper's, The Atlantic, Yale 360, The Nation, the LA Times, and elsewhere. He has been reporter, correspondent for the PBS News magazine show, Frontline, World and Now, with Bill Moyers. Mark teaches at the UC Berkeley Graduate School of Journalism and at the Montreux Institute for International Studies. His latest book, Carbon Shock, A Tale of Risk and Calculus on the Front Lines of the Disruptive Global Economy, published by Chelsea Green, is the product of 5 years of intensive reporting and writing from the hot spots where the cost of climate change are being experienced and fought over. Mark's previous books include Exposed, The Toxic Chemistry of Everyday Products, and What's at Stake for American Power, published through Chelsea Green, and Circle of Poison, Pesticides, and People in a Hungry World, with David Weir. Mark has won numerous awards, including a Society of Professional Journalists, Sigma Delta Chi, a DuPont Society of Environmental Journalists Reporting Award, and a Kurtschuk Award for International Reporting. Mark's presentation today is based on his latest book, Carbon Shock, A Tale of Risk and Calculus on the Front Lines of the Disrupted Global Economy. Please join me in welcoming Mark Shapiro.
Thank you. I always love the sound of this hammer when I hear it on the radio. It's just great to be here. Thank you all for coming out here a couple nights before Thanksgiving. I also have many times been in your position watching somebody speak up here, so it's a particular honor to me to be on this end of the room. So tonight, let's talk a little bit about climate change. And that's obviously the book that I've written. But what I want to do is I want to start in talking about this whole issue with a story of a rock. This rock I'm holding in my hand right now is a small rock. I describe it in my book as fist-sized rock. This rock, you could throw it. It would probably break a window. I'm not suggesting. I'm not going to do that. This rock actually comes from a very special place to me. And because this rock is covered in oil. And it was a stormy night in 2002, in November of 2002, right along the west coast of Spain, along an area called the Costa del Muerte, which is called the Coast of Death, where a lot of Spanish galleons sank to the bottom of the ocean, very rocky seas, the North Atlantic Ocean. And one evening in November 2002, an oil tanker passed through that coast, and that tanker was called the Prestige. And in the middle of a rocky storm, when waves were hitting about 20, 30 feet high waves, massive turbulent storm, the Prestige broke in half. A single whole oil tanker broke in half right up about 3 miles off the coast of Spain. And from its belly came 79 million gallons of oil. I have this rock because I collected it from a beach right along where the Prestige sank in Galicia. And the reason I have this rock is because it's reminded me for 10 years, for actually 12 years, since that time, of what it means, what our connection to fossil fuels, number one, means, and two, what this rock tells us about climate change. Embodied in this rock is the story of climate change. So let me tell you about what happened after the Prestige broke in two on this incredible stormy night. Basically, big chunks of oil spread across hundreds and hundreds of miles of the Galician coast. Anybody who's been to Spain knows that the Galician coast is rugged, it's rough, it's beautiful. It's not where anybody goes in a bikini. It's actually rough, North Atlantic, beautiful, rugged coast. And I went there several months after the accident for a story I did for Frontline World, the PBS show Frontline World. And I went onto those beaches. And I stood out on these rocky precipices out in the middle of nowhere in the North Atlantic, a place you would never normally go, and I'm not recommending you go. Harsh, windy, freezing, wet. And standing out on these rocks, I smelled the smell of a gasoline station. Hundreds of miles from the closest actual gasoline station. It was sickening. And I looked up to the north. It was nothing but boulders headed towards the northern part of Spain. I looked to the south, heading towards Portugal and Africa, more boulders covered in oil. Very much like the oil, exactly the same oil that's actually on this rock. The oil spill on the Prestige at that time unleashed a devastation across the marine economy in Spain. The marine economy was devastated. Thousands of fishermen lost their livelihood for that season and the subsequent season. A massive depression hit that part of Spain. I interviewed the mayor of the local town that was closest to the spill, Corcupion, a lovely little fishing village, who 2 years after... One year after 9/11, called this an act of terror on the shores of Spain. And so I wrote a story about this, and I actually did a television piece about this. There's somebody here in the audience who I worked with on that, David Richer. and I took with me a rock. I took this from the beaches, from that beach, because I never wanted to forget what it felt like to actually be standing there in the middle of an oil spill. And now let me tell you, I didn't know at the time that I would be writing a book about climate change. This was 12 years ago. But I've held on to this rock because I wanted to remember what environmental destruction is all about. It's been like a talisman for me. And as I've gone through the years, in the last 12 years, it's been sitting right above my desk, right on a little shelf above my desk, this little ugly rock, although I've kind of gotten sort of affectionate towards it, even though it's covered with the Prestige's oil. And it struck me that basically this rock is representative of the challenge that we face with climate change. Number one, you have emissions that come from everywhere, and they come from nowhere, right? CO2 comes from everywhere, all over Earth, which is actually nowhere when it comes to actually where they come from. They come from every single place on Earth. I would clarify that by saying that actually we do know where two-thirds of those emissions come from, which is 90 companies, which are listed, and actually 10 times 9 companies are responsible for two-thirds of those emissions. We can get to that a little later. But the basic idea that the emissions come from everywhere and they come from nowhere at the same time, very much like the oil and that Prestige. Where did the oil come from? The oil was owned by a Russian oligarch. The ship was owned by a Greek shipping family. The flag that it was flying was the flag of the Bahamas. And the legal registration for that ship was in that hotspot of regulation and dynamism called Liberia. Which is, by the way, where two-thirds of the oil tankers on the ocean today are registered, in Monrovia, Liberia. And I can give you the address. 80 Broad Street. If any of you are inclined on a little foray to Monrovia, Liberia, you'll find two-thirds of the paperwork for all the oil tankers on the ocean today registered there. Why? Because it shields them from liability. Which is the second reason why this rock is a symbol of climate change. 12 years after the accident, when the oil tanker, when the Prestige sank, 12 years after that accident, there has been no accountability for the damage that that ship and the oil it was carrying caused to the coast of Spain. It cost at least 5 or 6 billion euros to actually clean the, quote, clean the beaches. Of course, they never get cleaned, but to send out guys with power hoses and hazmat suits to go try to blitz the oil off the rocks, and to compensate the fishermen for an entire season of lost livelihood and many, many, many countless other damages. And I'll never forget actually seeing up and down the beaches right near this town, Corcubion, where volunteers had come from all over Europe sitting at these rocks with little spoons trying desperately to get this oil off the rocks. So 12 years after that accident, there's been no accountability whatsoever because all these mechanisms, you got the Greek ship owners, you got the oil from Russia, you got the flag from the Bahamas, you got the legal registration in Liberia. None of those have been able to be held accountable because of these complex series of trap doors, just like climate change. Who is responsible? Everyone and no one. And I will nuance that a little bit later on because obviously it's not no one. We broadly speaking, know who's responsible. We'll get to that in a minute. But basically, there's been no accountability for years for the externalized costs caused by climate change, for the costs of fossil fuels. And the third reason that this is a representative of climate change is because the oil in that case spread. And if you look at satellite photos of that time, which I did, the oil from that spill spread like a spider through the ocean of the North Atlantic, and it ultimately made it all its way 1,000 miles north all the way up to Spain, to France. Surfers in France were finding big clogs of oil on their surfboards, just like climate change, which is indiscriminate in its contamination of our Earth. So, there's another reason, which is why this is an image of climate change, this rock, because the oil that was carried in the belly of the Prestige was destined for Singapore. All right? So Singapore uses oil just like we use oil. Everybody uses oil. And here's a characteristic of that oil. Nobody in Singapore was ever going to pay the actual cost for that oil. Just like we in America and everywhere else on Earth don't pay the actual cost of the oil that was in the belly of that ship if it had made it to Singapore. And of course, needless to say, the only difference between the oil that ended up on the beaches of Spain and the oil that I put in my car every day, my little like 12-year-old Saab, is that my oil didn't take a little detour through the beaches of Spain. That's basically the only difference. And so this notion of what the costs are of fossil fuels, what the costs are of carbon, is fundamental to understanding what the situation that we face with climate change. Because the costs ultimately for the destruction that happened on the beaches of Spain was paid. It wasn't like it wasn't paid. Guess what? It was paid, of course, by the citizens of Spain, and in that case, the citizens of the European Union. It only took several years, by the way, for the United States to have a very similar and even more destructive spill, courtesy of British Petroleum in the Gulf of Mexico, which, of course, devastated the Gulf Coast and devastated the New Orleans and the coast of Louisiana on an even more monumental scale than the Prestige. And I, of course, watched that spill from afar. I didn't go to Louisiana, but I could see this kind of similar kind of phantom nightmare kind of unfolding with the same phenomenon unfolding. And in many ways, there are a lot of cross currents between those two stories. So the question when it comes to climate change climate change is a tale of externalized costs. That's really what the fundamental challenge is to the world, is to face these externalized costs. The people of Spain and the people of the European Union essentially subsidized the owners, who happened to be a Russian oligarch, and his oil, because they paid for the damages from that oil. And now, if you look at climate change in a way as letting loose an oil spill every day into the atmosphere of the planet, that's essentially what we're doing. So if you want to understand what climate change is, just imagine this rock going up every single day, another rock like this, billions of these kind of rocks going up every single day into the atmosphere of the planet. And that is essentially what climate change. Climate change is the ultimate externalized cost. It's the ultimate way in which the cheap costs we're paying for energy, actually specifically for fossil fuels, ends up being borne by us. So, part of what I do in the book, in Carbon Shock, is go on a journey to different parts of the world where these costs are being experienced to actually begin to understand the nature of these externalized costs. What are they? And actually, you know, the funny thing is, you don't have to go far to find them. Actually, you just have to open your eyes and find them. It's not like some big mystery out there. It's like the biggest secret hidden in plain sight that there's ever been. But I'll give you a couple of small examples, and of course I write about these somewhat more more in the book. But what do you suspect is the primary government program in the United States that is actually now seriously threatened by the phenomenon of climate change? Does anybody possibly guess what the most threatened government program is due to climate change? Well, okay. Thank you. I see a unison of responses. That's a great answer, actually. That's pretty good. And actually, it might even trump the answer I was going to say, because actually the military, of course, sees the huge national security implications of climate change, both the threat literally to the installations of the United States military, which are huge. If you're the U.S. Navy, you are definitely thinking about climate change. If you're the U.S. Army, you're thinking about how climate change affects your supply lines, and has actually declared formally that climate change poses a national security threat to the United States of America. As has the UK ministry, by the way, as is essentially the Ministry of Defense of every developed country. But the other thing that I was thinking of is, maybe you've got the military, that's pretty big, is something you might not assume is the case, but it's the crop insurance program of the United States. The crop insurance program, which subsidizes the ability of farmers to obtain insurance to insure their crops against altered conditions in growing. Government Accountability Office actually found last year that basically the crop insurance system was under severe threat because of all the monumental payouts that are being made to deal with the consequences of the climate change-induced changes in the conditions for farmers, whether it's drought, floods, extreme heat. Which has prompted the USDA for the first time to start making statements about climate change because of the money that it's costing the USDA. So that's one small example of an externalized cost. It's not a small example, a large example of externalized cost. Just a quick little tour of the externalized cost, just to make things kind of real for a moment. I was just down in New Orleans about 2 months ago, and I actually spent time walking along the levees that have been built after Katrina. And to withhold the rising sea and the next storm that comes through, a huge monumental concrete barrier that cost us, you and me, $14 billion. So climate change, of course, does not cause hurricanes. We know that. So let's get way beyond that. What it does do is it intensifies the hurricanes and the extreme weather events that come. So a huge proportion of that money can be ascribed to the effects of climate change. And scientists are involved in what exact percentage, and that's another question, but certainly a significant percentage. Climate change, there's other words for climate change. Maybe the way to think about climate change is with other words. People think about climate change, and they think climate change is kind of spooky. It's sort of out there. It's kind of happening way out there in the atmosphere. but there, and it may be happening in the future, and it's going to be happening down the line decades from now. But Lexi, why don't you call, next time you think of climate change, why don't you think of food crisis, which the FAO is now predicting there's going to be a food crisis because of immense stresses on the world's food. It's going to be a security threat, as I talked about with the EU and the U.S., both identifying this as a security threat. So there's a language issue here, and part of the reason I wrote this book was to begin to identify the many ways in which we're already paying for fossil fuels in ways that we don't normally associate with climate change. And in a way, the debate, we've been having this illusory debate in the United States, and this is kind of what I wanted to strike at, because the debate has been over, do we, for example, establish a price for carbon or do we not? Do we spend the money to invest and support renewable energy sources in the United States, or do we do not? As if it's an economic calculation in which we're dealing with all the numbers that are in front of us. But the fundamental illusion at the core of that debate is essentially that we haven't been accounting for the full costs of all this fossil fuels. And let me tell you, for those of you who are familiar with environmental issues, this notion of externalized costs is one that's been around for a long time. This is nothing new. I'm not like saying anything new about this question. But and I've been doing environmental journalism for Jesus like 30 years, so quite some time. And every time, whether it's toxic chemicals, pesticides, climate change, whatever it might be, there's always the question of externalized costs. I got tired of hearing the term. I got so tired of it, I just didn't want to hear it. It would put me to sleep, as it might be, hopefully not you at the moment. So what I did with my book, I really wanted to go out and show what those externalized costs are, what they feel like, where and how they're being experienced and people's response to them. And that was essentially one of the motives of this book, was to take a global journey and basically identify where those and how they're taking place. Because the climate change is happening in many, tend to think in very abstract terms about climate change. It's happening now in every single form of our lives. It is impacting the way that farmers are going to grow their food, the way that cities are designed over the coming decades, the way that huge food processing firms obtain, which food they obtain and from where. This is impacting, which is every kind of level of economic decision-making across the spectrum, which is why I called this book Carbon Shock, because that's what climate change is delivering to our economic order. And I describe that in the book, of course. So, in Carbon Shock, I try to articulate the actual costs of climate change. And my point is, in order to make the educated decisions that a society has to make in terms of how we allocate resources, we need to step out of this illusion that fossil fuels are somehow cheaper and look honestly at the costs and then decide. That's basically why I wrote the book. And I did it in such a way, hopefully, that is actually readable. I spent a lot of time developing stories and finding people in the Amazon jungle who are actually contending with some of the shifts in the Amazon and also trying to struggle with preserving forests where people actually live as carbon sinks, because forests are the best way to suck CO2 out of the atmosphere. But it gets very complicated when you're dealing with both people who live in those forests and they don't want to become offsets for Chevron Oil or General Motors. And you have fundamental shifts in those areas that are actually changing kind of life patterns in the Amazon and all the way to the Central Valley, where you have farmers who are contending on a daily basis with climate change. A lot of them would say, I don't know what the hell you want to call it, but something out there changed. You want to call it climate change? Call it climate change. Something out there is changing. It's just not like it ever was before. Cherry farmers, peach farmers, almond farmers, tomato farmers, melon farmers, they'll tell you the same thing. And they told me the same thing. They told me that. So the reason why this notion of a price for carbon is actually so important is because it enables us to provide, number one, an honest accounting for the cost of fossil fuels, and two, to create a more level playing field for competition with renewables, solar energy, wind energy. There's been a false competition until now, which is that wind and solar operating at a disadvantage. If you believe in the free market, basically the basic principles of the free, which we're all supposed to be living in this country, this thing called the free market, capitalism, et cetera, So one of the fundamental flaws of this kind of free market is that there is not an honest competition. There's not an honest accounting for the costs caused by fossil fuels. So when we begin to integrate those ideas, you end up with a far more level playing field with when it comes to solar and wind power and other kind of sources of renewables. So that was the point of the reporting that went into this book. And it ended up, I ended up writing along the way stories for Harper's Magazine about the carbon markets and the international carbon market and some of the ways they've attempted to apply a price for carbon. It gets really tricky when you start getting into geopolitical dynamics. I wrote about in the Atlantic, I wrote about the the battle that's still ongoing with the United States over and the European Union, battling over how to account for the costs of greenhouse gas emissions coming from airplanes. One of the big trade battles actually happening right now, right under your nose, your eyes, your radar screen, right under the popular radar screen, is this huge climate trade battle that's been going on after the European Union decided to begin charging airlines for the emissions coming from the back of their airplanes. Now, that brings us to the question of where is the action when it comes to dealing with climate change and the impacts of climate change. And I think what's actually very interesting, and I could give you a million sort of stories about, you know, the fossil fuel industries and et cetera, et cetera. I don't think that's as interesting as actually understanding where the action is and where the sources of tension are in the society as we move forward. Climate change basically challenges our existing. Climate change requires a shift in our understanding of where we get energy, which is, I think, should be evident to everybody here, and I think you probably know quite a bit about that. And many other people in the audience probably know the specifics of how you wire up a solar system to the grid and distributed grid. I'm not going to go into that now because I think, number one, it's broadly understood as being one of the fundamental shifts that has to happen. But to get to that point where we undergo this change in the society, we need a fundamental shift in our paradigms of power. And that's where things really get interesting around climate change. Because the if you look over the last 5 years, you see very significant historic challenges to the existing structure of our concept of national sovereignty, of how the limits to national sovereignty, how does climate change challenge our notions of national sovereignty and what a nation state can regulate, right, with a pollutant that is clearly international, comes from everywhere and comes from nowhere. Where does a nation state fit into this question? And it also requires a fundamental re-understanding of the limits of legal jurisdiction. And when you watch the negotiations unfolding, as you will over the next year, you'll have negotiations unfolding in Peru in a week, which is essentially a run-up to the negotiations happening in Paris in 2015, where they're supposed to renegotiate a global climate treaty. Watch for these areas of interesting tension. And I'll give you a couple of examples. When it comes to, so for example, we have this traditional idea that the nation state has the rights to regulate the land in which the nation state exists, of course, the territory of the nation state, the water. We have a treaty governing water rights, which I think is several miles off of everybody's coast. They get to regulate those waters. And there's been this deep presumption about the air, right? That everybody has an airspace. Well, what's very interesting is this, and I'll show you all the ways in which this fundamental challenge is happening. And I write about this in detail here because I take an I take an airplane flight from San Francisco to Siberia. I recommend it. Siberia is an amazing place. It'll take your breath away if you can ever make it out there. And I went out to do some training of Russian journalists in environmental journalism. And it was one of the most extraordinary experiences I've had. in this kind of birch forest out way out in the forest, a big university there. And they brought in journalists from all over Siberia who were doing amazing work. Actually, I noticed that the further you got from Moscow, the more amazing journalism was happening in Russia. And it's really pretty incredible. And Novosibirsk, by the way, was always a center of kind of independent thinking within the Soviet Union, even because it's so far from Moscow and nobody wanted to go there. But it's an amazing big city. And so I flew from San Francisco to Novosibirsk to Siberia. It's about an 18-hour trip or something. And what was interesting about that trip was my first leg of the flight was from San Francisco to Paris. During the course of that flight from San Francisco to Paris, my pilot on an Air France flight, the ticket was bought for me by the people doing the thing. By the time we got to Paris, the pilot of my flight had submitted our greenhouse gases coming from the back of the airplane to the aviation authorities in Paris. And we flew. You might probably broadly know you have to fly all the way over the United States or North America and then across the North Atlantic. We flew, broadly speaking, over Washington, D.C. Nobody from Washington, D.C. cared the slightest about the greenhouse gases coming from the back of the airplane that I was in. And yet by the time we landed, the pilot had to tell the aviation authorities how much our plane had emitted. I personally had a carbon footprint of probably about 1,500 pounds for that trip. The trip all the way to Russia. Number one, I know about that because I interviewed the pilot, and I didn't do it by kind of knocking on the cockpit door, by the way. So I'm not sure I recommend that kind of strategy. But I did introduce myself to the pilot before the plane took off, and I said, "Hi, I'm a journalist, and I'm curious about this greenhouse gases coming from airplanes, and I'd love to talk to you while we're flying. You know." I'm going to be sitting here. And he said, okay, you know, I'll try to come find you. And I didn't know anything was going to happen. So like 6 hours later, I was half dazed flying in this thing. The pilot came out, and we had this amazing chat as we hurtled, on automatic pilot, by the way, over the North Atlantic, and talked about the greenhouse gas submission he had to make to the authorities in Paris. And the reason for that was because the EU had just passed this measure that said, guess what? Airlines are responsible for like at least 5% of emissions that are going into the atmosphere. And the emissions that come out of the back of your airplane are far more destructive to the atmosphere than the emissions that even come from automobiles. So the effort to basically regulate those emissions for the entire course of that flight, and here's why it's important going down the line, because about 65% of my flight was in American airspace, the United States of America airspace. About 20% of my flight was over the North Atlantic, which is kind of nowhere airspace, everybody's airspace, international airspace. And about 15% of the flight was in European airspace. And the Europeans were saying, we want airlines to buy emission allowances for all those emissions going in and out of Europe. And the response of the United States airline industry was to sue the European Union, which has never happened before, but it was quite a sight. United, Continental, and American Airlines sitting there at this very fine, beautiful, modern court building in Luxembourg, beautiful Luxembourg, has this place called the European Court of Justice, which is a very important legal institution. And it's essentially the Supreme Court broadly. It's a different legal system, but it's the highest court within the European Union to arbitrate disputes with the European Union. And there were the three biggest American airlines suing the European Union to stop a law that had been passed by a democratic government. And that has never happened before. So if you want to talk about how climate change is changing our way of understanding the world and the interests that are at stake, that is a good one. And I described that in the book in this kind of legal case and the arguments that each side made. And ultimately, the important thing about this case is to understand that the European Court of Justice, again, like the Supreme Court of the EU, issued a decision which said that the EU has the right to regulate emissions outside of its national frontiers because climate change trumps these other concerns about national authority. There were some other factors as well, but that was the main idea coming out of that case. Huge. That has never happened before. So if you're starting to look at a shifting shape of the international legal system, you look to that case. It's fascinating. For law students, I think it's an amazing case to actually read, as I did, although I'm not a law student or a lawyer, but it's a fascinating document. But I want to raise the point because not only that, and I know we're running out of time, and I want to leave some time here for questions and stuff, but I do want to correlate that not all this is just happening in some distant place in the European Union. Our own state of California pushing the boundaries of what is a way to legitimately regulate greenhouse gases. Very interesting legal case, again, which expands the notion within American law. And that has to do with the renewable energy portfolio of the state of California, which some of you might be familiar with, which requires a steady reduction of fossil fuel-intensive energy over the coming decades. Started by Schwarzenegger, picked up and strengthened by Jerry Brown, and it's now in effect. And it affects the ways and the forms of energy that is obtained by California energy. And the low carbon fuel standard is very similar when it comes to liquid fuels for transport. What's interesting about that case is the state of California was sued by a bunch of Midwestern ethanol producers because they felt that the state's relatively stringent laws regulating the amount of carbon dioxide that's emitted from biofuels. Much more emitted by Midwestern fuels based on corn than the California-based kind of algae and weed and other kind of vegetable oils have a much lower carbon footprint in California than they do in the Midwestern corn. So state of California is sued by the Midwestern corn ethanol producers on the grounds of violation of interstate commerce. As you know, very important principle, uniting the United States as a single economy. And the first stage they won, the California law was put on hold, and then it was appealed to the Ninth Circuit, based right here in San Francisco, and the Ninth Circuit found in favor of the state of California. Why? This is also very interesting and another thing to remember. The state of California was using a life cycle analysis. When I first heard that term, I thought it was some kind of Buddhist kind of ceremony that I had to kind of figure out and chant to get, you know, in that state. And then I realized it's actually a fundamental idea of, you know, of environmental thinking, and the life cycle being the production, distribution, and disposal of goods over the course of their life cycle. To establish the California renewable energy portfolio, they've done a very substantive life cycle analysis of the kinds of energy that goes into the state of California. Why is that important? Because for the first time in American law, the Federal Court of Appeals, one step below the Supreme Court, declared that the use of life cycle analysis by the state of California to establish the rules governing the types of energy that the state of California could use was legitimate. It was the first time life cycle analysis had ever made its way into a legal decision, I promise you that. And why that's important is because this expands the purview of American law. Right? So when you think about climate change, and I'm trying to articulate this idea that basically the action is all around us, and it's happening both on mega levels when it comes to geopolitical negotiations, and it's also happening on very specific levels when it comes to how the government exercises power. And I'll just give you two very quick more examples of ways of how climate change is beginning to expand our existing principles of more, a couple of other ideas, liability. How do you hold companies liable for a problem that is basically, the problem comes from here, but the problem is everywhere. How do you establish liability for that? This is one of the fundamental challenges that we now face. Thankfully, this great journal called Climatic Change, which is a peer-reviewed journal, came out with a story about a study by scientists, peer-reviewed by other scientists, identifying that two-thirds of the greenhouse gas emissions in the world are created by 90 companies, so we actually know who's responsible. But this notion of how to hold them liable for these damages is fundamental to the debates that are ongoing right now. And And the notion of who is responsible for these damages, huge development when it comes to China's recent agreement with the United States. There is no question it could have been stronger, but the notion that a developing country like China, rapidly developing, would commit itself to some level of emission reductions challenges the division of the world between developed country and developing country, right? There's a huge shift going on in the sort of global architecture of power. And one of those is the increasing responsibility that some developing countries are taking, and particularly China in this case, to deal with their emissions. There's a lot more that I could actually talk about in terms of how climate change is altering our notions of power, and how, not to mention our economic order. But the reason I wrote this book, Carbon Shock, is because I wanted to demonstrate how these huge fundamental shifts that are happening in our natural order have their corollary on our economic system. And that's, I think, a very important part of this discussion that I think is kind of key to comprehend and actually enable us to basically make more educated decisions moving forward. So I try to do that with kind of stories in different parts of the world where a lot of these actions are taking place. People in the middle of these big changes around the world. So with that, I will close. Thank you.
Well, thanks to Mark for his comments here today. We like to remind our listening audience that this is a program with the Commonwealth Club of California, and you're listening to Carbon Shock, a tale of risk and calculus on the front lines of the disrupted global economy with Mark Shapiro. Now, we open the floor to a Q&A. Please keep your questions short and to the point. Also, please be sure that your questions are, in fact, questions and not statements. We have Sue standing up. Microphones up here, down here actually. If you have any questions, please line up behind one of these microphones and speak into the microphone as we are recording.
Thank you so much for your presentation. Wonderful narrative of the changes that are occurring in our economy and our environment.
Thank you.
I was wondering if you might speak about carbon markets and your firsthand experience of them. They seem really arcane, but I know they're changing the world because the price of carbon is one of the key influencers in adopting new technology and changing things. So I'd like you to talk a little bit about that.
Okay. Well, all right. That's a good question. I figured we would want to deal with carbon markets at some point. I've written so much about them that I thought. This is fundamental. So this challenge that the world faces to establish this price for carbon, very rapidly, go back to Kyoto Protocol, big debate, would it be a carbon tax or would there be a cap and trade system? The European Union, in alliance with the G77 developing countries, favored a carbon tax, which was broadly perceived as a direct price for fossil fuels. And the United States insisted that it be done through a market mechanism and essentially threatened to withdraw from the talks if that wasn't the case. So the whole world basically changed, or the rest of the world changed its tune and endorsed the notion of cap and trade back in 1997 as a way to leverage the price of carbon higher. Without going into all the details of a very, very complex cap-and-trade system, this cap-and-trade system was established to provide emission limits in countries that signed the Kyoto Protocol. Companies that met those limits, companies that were over those limits had to purchase emission allowances. Companies that were lower than those limits could sell those emission allowances. It seemed like a beautiful kind of balancing act. And that way you would generate a price for carbon through the top emitters of the world. 4 years later, change in government, You might remember George W. Bush was elected president. Within a month, he had withdrawn Thank you for a little water. So 1 month after George Bush gets into office, he withdraws the United States from the Kyoto process. Condoleezza Rice, his national security advisor, says Kyoto is dead. Well, guess what? Kyoto never died. And all the other countries that had signed Kyoto, and particularly the European Union, Japan, New Zealand, went forward with this idea that had been designed by the Americans. So basically, they were left to execute a plan that had been designed by the Americans, and that they had specifically allowed to happen because they wanted the Americans as part of the picture. And then the Americans left the picture, but they were left with this program. So we have now carbon markets, as you've indicated. Now we have this one in California, obviously, and a lot of the carbon trading. Carbon traders are right here in downtown San Francisco. I go into this in detail in the book. The fundamental problem, or fundamental challenge of the carbon markets has been that they've never really reached the point where a price for carbon was reached that would actually significantly change investment decisions. So most resource economists will tell you need a price of $40 to $50 minimum a ton to actually change the investment decisions of major industries. In California, certainly it's been hovering around $10 to $14, $15 a ton. In Europe, it reached a peak of about $30 a ton, but then dropped over the last 2 years to about more like, you know, $2 to $8 a ton, is now kind of clambering back up to $10 to $13 a ton. So there's been enormous inefficiencies in the carbon markets. And two, there's an enormous amount of the money that is going into them is generated to arbitrage companies who actually trade on the market. So the World Bank has done a study and showed that essentially 25% of the money on the European market anyway is secondary market, is through speculators, which means that 25 cents out of every dollar goes to Goldman Sachs and Bank of America and all the other guys who have carbon trading desks. Who have had carbon trading desks there. So there is great potential for the cap and trade system if it's aggressively monitored and the price does continuously rise and it's done in a predictable fashion, which would enable companies to actually know what kind of price for energy they're facing. But there's been so much volatility that it's been hard to say that they've accomplished what they were hoping to accomplish at this stage. And I write about it in quite a bit of detail in here. So I hope that answers it without going into all the kind of trap doors of the system, which you may be familiar with somewhat.
We'll take the next question.
Thank you. In the course of your research, have you encountered information about the expenditures put forth by carbon emitters to subvert the regulatory process? I'm thinking of, you know, AstroTurf organizations, various sorts of efforts like that. And how do you see them weighing on the political question of carbon emissions?
You mean the denier organizations?
Yeah, essentially denier organizations, but more specifically, how much effort financially has gone into that effort?
Well, it's interesting that you asked that question because, number one, the climate deniers are basically getting outpaced by some of the industries that, in a way, the U.S. Congress is now more climate denying than many of the leading industries in the United States. It's really amazing. They're like frozen in some time. They've been outpaced by ExxonMobil. They've been outpaced by Chevron, all of whom, and I describe this in the book, and I have a whole chapter on the oil industry and of course, the story of this rock, of the rock from the Prestige, but it's the whole oil industry. And what's interesting in relation to your question is the major fossil fuel companies now explicitly acknowledge climate change. So ExxonMobil, I actually just, I have some of this in the book, and then I wrote a kind of a follow-up piece for Yale 360, this environmental magazine out of Yale. And it was about the carbon price established by ExxonMobil. Guess what? ExxonMobil has a carbon price. They integrate that price into their accounting system. The price, they create that price based on a whole number of different factors, including the threat of regulation, including the threat that climate change presents to their infrastructure. And guess what? They actually look and register the public pressure that's being put on governments to act on carbon. So who was following the climate demonstrations in New York about a month ago in New York? You might have been following it. I was trying to keep track from here just to see what was going on. And ExxonMobil was following it very closely because they write their climate, their carbon price within their company based partly on the public pressure to act on climate change. So that's a long way to answer number one. The major American companies, if you look at General Mills, the big food processing company, hugely concerned about climate change explicitly because they're concerned about the supply chain of all those cereals and grains going to their processing facilities. Numerous, numerous examples like that. And so actually what you have now is this disjunction between the largest companies in America and the U.S. political order, which is still, you know, fixed in this kind of, you know, there's no other way to describe it, just this blind, willful, blind position, largely at the behest of the Koch brothers and others who themselves are being outpaced by other fossil fuel intensive industries. So hopefully that answers somewhat of your question. Yes.
Thank you. Yeah, in Texas, a gallon of regular costs about $3. While in France, it costs $8. Perhaps like yourself, I'm a proponent of wildly increasing carbon taxes in the United States. The question becomes, I think, though, what do you do with the proceeds? If we were to increase carbon taxation in the United States, what do you do with the money? The Harvard economist Jorgensen, in the book Double Dividend, recently suggested that we increase the capital gains tax deduction. So what do you think, sir? What do we do with increased carbon tax proceeds?
Yes, yes. Very totally good question and a great, a central question, this whole debate. It's very fundamental that the money that's generated from a carbon tax, number one, that at least a significant amount of the burden is placed on the fossil fuel companies themselves, so we just don't have more expensive gas, but the profit ratios stay the same. Two, that basically and every proposal that's been made so far includes what's known as a dividend, which is money that's returned to American consumers. So basically there's a way to do that. So a significant amount of the money goes back to American consumers to kind of offset that extra price for carbon. And that was certainly done in Australia, which, of course, as some of you might know, didn't last too long because the government got ousted. But their program had, I think, a 40% dividend return to the citizens of Australia. So I think that's a key part of the picture is who ultimately ends up paying. And when we think about a carbon tax, the notion is to create a sense of equity so that some of that money goes back to consumers and goes to dealing with the consequences of climate change, because somebody's got to pay for all those levies. Somebody's got to pay for San Francisco just staying local, buttressing its coast, which, as we all know, is shrinking because the ocean is rising. And somebody's got to pay for those things. Now they're in our general tax pool, but there's a way to create a targeted fund that would actually enable us to deal directly with climate change. So I think that the answer to your question would be some combination of dealing directly with the cost of climate change, plus kicking some of that money back to consumers so that the overall burden doesn't land on us.
Thank you, Mark, for your great work. Could you speak to what extent do you think that the climate change challenge is a challenge based on the capitalist growth model, and that even if we tinker with some fixes here and there in how we grow, that fundamentally part of the equation is the imperative to continually grow and produce more and consume more. Could you speak to that issue a bit? Thank you.
Well, that's a substantive question, Chris. Well, two parts of the of that question. Number one, in writing this book, I was very concerned with how the existing system that we have today could be reformed in substantive ways. I don't actually, reform is even the wrong word. It's to be made more honest and actually about the cost of fossil fuels. So there's a way actually in which an enormous amount would be gained if we had a system of honest accounting. Nobody goes into the street for the big banner saying honest accounting. You know, it's pretty damn boring. But I tried to make it interesting. I think there's actually a lot of stories in here that illustrate what the hell that idea is. But anyway, this notion, which actually in itself, if you actually did that, you would fundamentally change the kind of decisions that were made in the society when it comes to energy. And I think the fundamental reality, as appealing as that idea is, as appealing as the idea of reducing your consumption as a way to reduce our carbon footprint, I think we can all try to do that in our own ways. First of all, it's very difficult to go tell somebody in India or China to go reduce their consumption because you've had 200 years to enjoy your consumption. So that will not get you very far in the developing world. And as I think rather than framing it that way, I think if you begin to actually price carbon accurately and you have a mechanism that actually kicks that money back to the social good and actually kicks that money back to helping us wean ourselves off of fossil fuel energy, you're going to end up with a lot less of this kind of consumption, wasteful consumption that we now have. So, then it's a question of less consumption of what? I mean, basically, if you consume more goods at your same level of less carbon intensity, you are actually creating less strain on the atmosphere. So I'm not sure I'm quite ready to jump into this whole notion that people are supposed to sort treating this like an ascetic in I didn't write this book to actually have a moral pointing of the finger or an ascetic point of view. I'm not an ascetic. I would bet most of you out here are not ascetic, but you can actually be conscious in how energy is produced and be conscious, much more conscious in the way that society is organized. And that's what I would say in response to that.
We have time for only one last question.
Thank you for your great work. One thing that's come out of the climate science is that they found that there's a great deal of delay between the moment of having actually polluted and the moment when the greatest extent of consequences are felt from that pollution. So climate scientists have found that in the hypothetical where all forms of human pollution right now were to cease, we would still see devastation, pretty significant damage done to our environments going decades out, simply because of what we've already put into the environment. And then given certain difficulties with working with governments and the whole host of different challenges that are involved with trying to tackle this problem, isn't it a little bit too optimistic to say that we really have a chance of adequately dealing with this and instead it should be a matter of trying to find a way to survive climate change rather than solve it?
Well.
Yeah. Sorry, I'm a bit of a pessimist on this.
I guess so. let me see if I can address that, your concerns there. There's always been a dark life, a dark aspect of human. You know, look at the German expressionists. Look at many. I basically think that the way to look at climate change is to, number one, understand that it's happening now, right? So it's not like we're waiting for some apocalyptic thing to happen. You're living through it right now. This is kind of, you know, what is this ridiculous? It's November 25th to have a day like today. Gorgeous day, but that's just a small incidental detail, really. But you are already living through climate change, right? So, and you're already paying for fossil fuels. So the decisions that we face now are decisions about how extreme the conditions are going to get, right? We can slow down those emissions, and we can slow them down seriously, you know. And if we do that, the extremity of those conditions that you're talking about will be less. They won't go away. Climate change is already here, so we have to get over this notion that this is something about our grandkids and our grandkids' grandkids. It's actually for us. So the question is, how do we act today to reduce the emissions, to decrease the consequences in the future, and, very importantly, decrease the costs in the future? And the Council on Economic Advisers in the United States, from the White House, actually said that if emissions continue on the current level, the costs of climate change are going to increase 40% every decade if things keep going on this level. Obama, I guarantee you, was extremely aware of that report when it came out about 2 months ago, as was every world leader who gathered in New York and are basically and who sat at the table when the Chinese and the Americans sat down to talk about these consequences. So the issue is not, are we going to stop climate change? We're not going to stop it. It's already happening. It's how we deal with the extremities that are coming down the line. And then to add to you, obviously, I think you're right in saying that we need to start allocating resources to deal with the consequences. And by the way, we're already doing that. You know, if you go to New York, they're ready for the next Sandy. You go to New Orleans, they're getting ready for the next Katrina. And you go to the Midwest, and you have all these farmers who are hoping to get through next year, but they were helped by the crop insurance system, which is going to get in more and more perilous condition if we don't act now. So that's my way of flipping your pessimism and turning it on its head and basically saying that the time to act is now. And if you go around the world, it's not like I took a around the world thing, but over the course of 5 years, I went to different parts anyway. I went to London and Manchester and the Amazon and different parts of the United States. And it's incredible, actually, how much is happening around the world. You know, we're kind of like stuck here in America, and we're kind of thinking that we've got this crazy Congress that's kind of frozen in place. We're in this kind of nice state that's kind of at the forefront, more like Europe than it is in like Washington. But there's actually a huge amount that's happening all over the world in small levels. I spent some time in Rio de Janeiro. They have a very far-seeing kind of administration, the city and the state of Rio de Janeiro, trying to do rapid transit system. They're extremely aware of climate change and the impact that's having on Brazil. Same thing in China. Those people are seeing these studies that are happening, the transformation in China. So not to think of yourself as isolated and watching these changes wash over us, but to be aware that all over the world there's incredible action happening. And that's one of the reasons why I wanted to articulate some of these kind of precedent-setting changes that are afoot, because they're happening on big levels, small levels, in parallel ways, simultaneously, in ways that I try to actually evoke the kind of simultaneity of some of this action and try to get across. So I hope that.
Thank you.
Great. Thank you.
Thanks
so
much.
Nice to meet you all. I'll be sitting outside with some books and love to have a chat.
Our thanks to Mark for his comments here today. We also thank our audience here, as well as those listening to this recording. And now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, commemorating its 111th year of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.